stopping you from becoming a Catholic?
Why can't women become priests?
1-833-288-EWTN.
I don't understand why I have to earn salvation.
1-833-288-3986.
What's stopping?
Why do I need to confess my sins to a priest?
What's stopping you? This is Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome again to Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon. Delighted to have you with us. Here it is Thanksgiving week, but we are here. We are live on this Monday, and we would love to hear from you if you've got a question about the Catholic faith. Here's our phone number, 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Outside North America, please dial 1 and then 205-271-2985. And you can also send us an email if you would like to do that. The address for that is ctc@ewtn.com. Greetings to all of you who are watching us on YouTube or Facebook this afternoon. You can put your questions in the chat screen if you would like, and we will take it from there. Our producer, Pedro Quiles, ready to roll here. Matt Kubinski handling the phones, and Vanessa Sanchez is doing social media, so she'll be looking for those questions that you want to post online. I'm Tom Price, along with Dr. David Anders.
Tom, how are you today?
Well, I'm doing very well. I want to give out a little shout to our friends in Rapid City, South Dakota.
Yes, it's going to be a shout from a long distance, unfortunately. You know, I was scheduled to go speak in Rapid City last Thursday, so we didn't have a live show Thursday or Friday.
Right, right.
And I spoke in Rapid City, did end up speaking, well, I should say to Rapid City, but stranded in a hotel room in Dallas, Texas.
Oh, boy.
Right? So we did it, you know, by the computer because I was supposed to switch planes in Dallas, Texas. And if you've seen the news, hundreds and hundreds of flights were canceled in Dallas on Thursday.
Including yours.
Including thousands of people stranded. And so so that's how that shook out.
But you've got that show must go on attitude, as everybody does in Catholic radio.
Well, and they do too. Real Presence are real troopers, you know. So I appreciated the invitation to be up there with them. And sorry I couldn't be with you in person, guys, but well, God bless you.
Absolutely. Love our friends there at Real Presence Radio. We're going to begin with an email from Frank in Yonkers, New York. This is not so much a question as it is a reflection. So he says, Dear Dr. Anders, in the New American Bible, St. Joseph edition, the following components of the Lord's Prayer are interpreted in the following ways, which I never hear anybody talk about. I like this more in-depth interpretation of the components. It gives more meaning to me for this prayer. So here are the components he's talking about. Give us this day our daily bread. The petition would be for a speedy coming of the kingdom. And forgive us our debts, sins, debts. The request is probably for forgiveness at the final judgment. And do not subject us to the final test, but deliver us from the evil one. Jewish apocalyptic writings speak of a period of severe trial before the end of the age called the Messianic Woes. This petition asks that the disciples be spared that final test. God bless. Frank in Yonkers, New York. So any thoughts about that reflection?
Well, I will say this, that there is a very long history of Catholic commentary on the Lord's Prayer, as you might imagine.
Oh, yeah.
And with very few exceptions, the Catholic Church does not actually dogmatize, here's how a particular passage of the Bible must be interpreted. There are very few passages of Scripture where the Church has said, this must be read in this sense, which leaves plenty of room for Catholics to read texts and derive different insights from them and bring different tools of critical analysis to their study. So have at it, Frank.
Well, there you go. So, Frank, thanks so much for your email today from Yonkers, New York. Here's one now from Paige, who says, on your show of 11-11 a couple of weeks ago, you read an email from a listener who was embarrassed to go to confession. You recommended they go to a neighboring parish, that the priest is behind the screen and would not recognize your voice. Well, I recently returned to the church after being away for some 20 years. I have gone to confession in several different parishes in California and Nevada. The priest is no longer behind a screen. You are face to face with the priest. When did this change take place? Thanks for what you do, Paige.
Yeah, thank you. Well, there are still plenty of churches, Catholic churches, where you can go to confession anonymously. There are still plenty where you can do that. But since the Second Vatican Council, there's been a bit more leeway in the construction of church architecture and this sort of thing. And so there are occasions when, you know, it's kind of unavoidable to go to confession face-to-face. You know, I've been to confession, for example, to priests that are hard of hearing and have to read lips. Well, I mean, try reading lips behind a screen. You know, that's not going to happen, all right? Famous case of St. Damien of Molokai, who was confined to a leper colony in the Hawaiian Islands. When he went to confession, he couldn't actually be in the physical proximity of the priest because he didn't want to infect him with leprosy. And so what they came to was that St. Damien got in a boat and the priest would get in another boat. These boats are, you know, manned vessels that have, a, you know, crew on board. Yeah. And they would, you know, come within about 20 feet of each other. And then St. Damien would shout his confession across the open water. Now, if memory serves me correct, I think he didn't confess in English. He would confess in, did he confess in French? What language did he
could
confess
be French.
I think he confessed in French. So, you know, many of the crew wouldn't have spoken the language, but nevertheless, he's still shouting his confession in the open sea, right? There's no other way to get it done. So that's what I have to say about that.
All right. Thanks so much for that. And this one from Bernard. Can we have a personal relationship with the saints?
Yeah, thanks. Well, it all depends on what you mean by the term personal relationship. So do you mean, can I have a personal relationship with the saints the way I would have a personal relationship with Tom here? You know, can I invite them to dinner and sit down and have a reciprocal one-on-one conversation? And how was your day? And tell me what's going on in your life? And you know, the saint says, well, you know, I had 32,000 requests for intercession today, and it was a slugger of a day. No, you're not going to have that kind of a relationship. To be in relation is to have some kind of orientation towards something that's not you, right? And here's what I think you could do with respect to relationship to a saint. You can definitely talk to the saint. No guarantee you will get an audible answer back.
Yeah.
All right. You can study the saint's life. You can imitate the saint's example. You can seek the saint's intercession. And you can trust that through the providence and the Spirit of God that the saint will be interceding on your behalf. That's what you can do.
Very good. Bernard, thanks so much for your email. Calls are coming in right now, but we would love to hear from you as well. 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986 for Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN. Calls are coming in right now at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for Dr. Anders, 833-288-3986. We would love to talk with you this afternoon. Here's something I'd like to talk with you about today right now. It is the Jesse Tree Ornaments Book and Madonna and Child Tapestry Storage Pouch. EWTN's religious catalog has you covered this coming Advent. You can enjoy a set of 27 Jesse Tree ornaments this year, many more Advent seasons to come. The ornaments are designed and 100% made in Steubenville, Ohio, by Catholic families. They depict subjects based on meditations from the book The Jesse Tree, an Advent devotion by Eric and Susan Sammons, which is included with this set. The Jesse Tree practice, if you're not familiar with it, it begins on this first Sunday of Advent, which is this Sunday. Can you believe it? It's already Advent? Wow! Since the number of days in Advent varies from year to year, there's a handy chart included with the package here to help you know which ornament to hang on which day. And when the season is over, you can store your Jesse Tree ornaments and book in a beautiful Madonna and Child tapestry pouch. The tapestry tablet and Bible case features a beautiful image of Madonna and Child on both sides. The versatile case is also a great way to carry a notebook or pens, pencils, highlighters, straight edge, page flagging tabs, and other Bible study tools. So we got you covered here. Go to EWTNRC.com, type in Advent or Jesse, and you'll get it. EWTNRC.com. Buy Catholic, shop Catholic. with us, EWTN's Religious Catalog. All right, if you're ready now, let's go to the phones at 833-288-EWTN, beginning with John in Michigan, listening on Sirius XM, Channel 130. Hey there, John, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, I just wanted to give a comment. They talked about the confessional that changed with from the hidden side to in front of a priest. When I returned to the church was a few years ago, and I did do the original confession I did behind the screen.
Uh-huh.
But I was talking to someone later, and they told me, oh, yeah, back when we had a German priest here, he says, man, that people just lined up because he didn't know what he was talking about. So that just kind of hit me like, that's not forgiveness. And so I just went straight to the priest and asked for, you know, a special time. But a friend of mine put it very distinctly. He says, I wasn't ashamed when I caused the sin. Why should I be ashamed now to go to a priest in person? So that was just my comment.
Yeah, well, I really appreciate that a lot. And it reminded me of a story that was an Irish priest in my own diocese. He's dead now. Like many people, generation ago, it was not uncommon for young Irish boys to be sponsored by an American diocese who would pay their seminary studies in Ireland on the condition that after the ordination, they would come and serve their time in a diocese in the United States. So we got a lot of Irish guys still running around in American churches because of that deal that we made with the Irish church. It was a great benefit to both communities. But anyway, this fellow had that GI Bill, if you will. You know, and he did his studies in Ireland, and then he gets ordained, and he is flown directly to Birmingham, Alabama. And this probably would have been in the 60s. And if you've listened to old newscasts, you know that there's a kind of standard Southern vernacular from the 60s that basically doesn't exist anymore, right? Except, you know, our outgoing Governor Kay Ivey still kind of has it if you listen to her. But, you know, like, people don't talk that way anymore around here because of television and the monoculture of American
media. It's all been homogenized.
Has homogenized that. Yeah, exactly. But so he would have arrived at a time when you still had, a deeply regional Southern vernacular. He was from Ireland, and they flew him in, and they popped him right in the confessional at St. Paul's Cathedral. It probably wasn't even the cathedral church yet at that point, but St. Paul's Parish that became our cathedral church. Uh-huh. And he said he heard confessions, got right off the plane. He heard confessions for like 3 hours. And he said to me, I didn't understand a single word that anybody said to me.
Wow.
It was in English, and he didn't know what was going on. You know, it took him a while to catch on. And I know, you know, I've heard stories about American priests who would hear confessions in Spanish, and some of the Hispanic folks would line up behind the American because they knew he didn't understand what they were saying, you know.
Wow.
So I understand that. I could tell stories, but I'll stop. Your point is interesting. Now, you know, when I think about, well, why would that be the case? Why would somebody not be ashamed to commit the sin but ashamed to confess it? And I think there's a couple of reasons that would come into that. One is that the normal human response is self-justification. Whenever we commit a misdeed, our natural tendency is to excuse ourselves, to say, well, I did it because of these extenuating circumstances, or, you know, or he did it first, or I'm not to blame, or, you know, these kinds of justifications always come in because we do have an ideal image of who we think we are. And then our actions belie that conviction all the time. And so we have to come up with ad hoc explanations for why we're really not that bad a guy after all. And the difference is in the confessional is you're not allowed that self-justifying behavior. You just have to face up to it flat out. And
yeah,
a lot of times when we engage in the behavior, we're simultaneously engaging in the self-justification. I think this would be particularly true, for example, in interpersonal conflict. Somebody gets mad and yells at their spouse. Well, it's because he's such a bad guy or she's such a bad guy that I did that. It's all my spouse's fault. And, you know, and the priest in the confessional doesn't want to hear about how it's your spouse's fault. He wants to hear about your fault, right? That's what you're there for. My mentor, Father Lambert Green, and another Irish priest, although he wasn't a transplant like those guys, told me one time, and this is all anonymous, I don't know any names, and it happened decades ago, so it wasn't a violation of the seal.
Okay.
He said a couple came to him in Ireland one time for marriage counseling, and he said, okay, but before marriage counseling, I want you each to go to confession. And so the husband and the wife both went to confession. And they got out of confession. He said, okay, now you've left the confessional. I know nothing. Seal of the confessional. Everything you've said, I've forgotten, right? But he said, truth is, what they said, they turned around and said the exact opposite in marriage counseling that they revealed
really?
In the confessional. Meaning, like, in confession, they were like, yeah, I've made some mistakes. But when they're, like, in the public eye and they've got their spouse there, it's all the other guy's fault.
Oh boy.
Right, you see, that's a natural human tendency.
I guess it is. John, thanks so much for your call. That's a great way to kick us off here, and that opens up a line for you at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. David, I got to tell you, we got a tip on a very interesting mini series that we thought we would watch the other night. And it took place in the 80s in London. And as we're watching it, it's like, well, you know how many dialects there are in England.
Oh, yeah.
And we couldn't understand it. I mean, it's in English in the 1980s, so it wasn't old English. And I'm looking around for the closed captioning button, couldn't find it. We finally had to bail out on it because it was just ununderstandable.
You know, when I was writing my master's thesis, which I absolutely do not invite you to go read. It's not one of the best pieces of scholarship I ever did.
Okay.
But when I was writing my master's thesis, I was writing on this obscure French reformer named Pierre Viollet. And he wrote in French, 16th century French. And I found out, you know, I've spoken through all these microfiche of 16th century sources, that there were some contemporaneous English translations of Viollet's work that Protestants in England had made. And
okay.
So I said, that's interesting, I get a hold of those. And so I got a hold of some of those microfiche from the university library, and I started looking at them, and I thought, the French is easier to understand. I went back to the French. It was harder to understand the English.
That is funny. It's called A Communion here on EWTN. Lines are open for you at 833-288-EWTN. If you have a question for David, 833-288-3986. Brenda is in Fulton, New York, listening on the EWTN app, a free download. Hey there, Brenda, what's on your mind today?
Hi, yes. I think you may have answered this before, but I don't think I've heard it. And I am a former Seventh-day Adventist. I've been Catholic for 10 years, out of the church for 18. And I was at a funeral on Friday, and they brought up the great controversy, and I just wondered if you're familiar with that, with the book, Ellen White, and what is your opinion about it?
So I know that Ellen White wrote a book called The Great Controversy that details the history of cosmic conflict between God and Satan. Right? That's about as much as I know of the details about that particular book, which I have not read. I know that sort of the larger Seventh-day Adventist narrative embeds that in a specific eschatology. In which the Catholic Church doesn't fare too well, I say, in the general Adventist positions, and I have thoughts about that. And then, of course, it also assigns a particularly special role to Ellen White, who's a kind of modern day prophetess, and who's alleged to speak with authority to Adventists and to all people in the name of Jesus. And I have issues that I would take with that as well. I will say there are some things I really admire about the Seventh-day Adventist tradition. You probably know this, but maybe our listeners don't, that if you look at the blue zones, that is the areas of the world where people have disproportionately high numbers of centenarians,
people over 100.
Yeah, so Okinawa, Japan is one of them. You know, I think Sardinia is one. Loma Linda, California is one of the blue zones, and it's seemingly because of the high proportion of Seventh-day Adventists that live there. Who eat a generally healthy, bordering on vegetarian diet.
Wow.
And so I like that about them. I like that they eat healthy and live long and would seem to have a regard for natural law as a moral concept in other respects. So I think they've sort of missed the point of the New Testament.
Brenda, thanks so much for your call. Thanks for checking in from Fulton, New York. Mustafa is listening to us in Pennsylvania, actually watching us on YouTube this afternoon. Mustafa, what's on your mind today?
Is my voice clear?
Yes,
oh, yeah. Yes, go right ahead.
Thank you so much. And even though I'm still following EWTN. So the question is, if salvation is through Christ, what happens to the billions who lived before Christ or never heard of it? So is it fair that some people never even had a chance to hear about Jesus? So what does God do with them? And I hope for clarification, and God bless you.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So the people who have not heard of Jesus if they are saved through the Jesus in whom they have not heard. The Catholic doctrine is that God became a man, uniting divinity to our humanity, that humanity might be united to the Godhead. And that happens when one responds to the light and grace of God that is made manifest to one. And, of course, it's a divine initiative. I mean, we don't save ourselves. God saves us. But he offers us the opportunity to collaborate, to cooperate with the grace he offers us. Now, that grace can be offered in ways more or less explicit. So, you know, for example, when Moses spoke to God through the theophany of the burning bush, that was a pretty explicit engagement with Moses. I mean, if I came home and my rosemary bush was on fire, you know, and a voice comes out of the rosemary bush and says, you know, David, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and I'm here to tell you, don't you forget your wife's birthday, right? I think I would not forget my wife's birthday that year.
Definitely.
I mean, that would really come loud and clear, all right? That doesn't usually happen to me. I might instead have, you know, sort of a vague twinge of conscience and be like, oh yeah, can't forget April, you know, Jill's birthday is coming up. And conscience is the aboriginal vicar of Christ, you know, the voice of conscience in a way speaks authoritatively for God. But it's not nearly as poignant as a voice coming out of a burning bush, right?
Yeah.
And that's kind of how the Catholic Church views this relation, right? That no one is deprived entirely of light or the offer of grace to respond to. The grace won for us by Christ, made possible by the Incarnation and his passion, death, and resurrection. For some, that offer will be more explicit. And so if you have the grace and the benefit of being exposed to the full teaching of the Catholic Church and all the sacramental means of grace, well, you're in a pretty good way. If you don't have that opportunity, it doesn't mean you're deprived of every possibility of salvation. And if you're saved at all, you're saved through the grace of the Christ in whom you may not yet have heard.
Mustafa, thank you so much for your call today here on EWTN's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. A quick question here from Charles. How should Catholics respond to churches like Hagia Sophia that was taken over by Muslims?
I think you mean how should we feel about that? How should we think? Well, obviously, I'm not a big fan of imperialism, whether that imperialism be fomented by Muslims or Catholics, right? I wouldn't be in favor of, say, the Catholic Church endorsing a military campaign against a Muslim holy site or place of worship and taking it over and converting it into a Catholic church. And I'm not in favor of Muslims doing that to Catholic places of worship. That has happened, right? Obviously, in the case of the Hagia Sophia. Would I rather it be functioning as a Catholic church? Yeah, I'd rather it be functioning as a Catholic church. It isn't. And I don't think there are any prospects in the future of it ever being returned to its intended use. And so I review that as a kind of historical accident. Scripture tells me that, you know, God doesn't dwell in tents built by human hands. And the ultimate temple of God in the new covenant is the people of God, the church. You know, where the church is, there is the presence of God, and where the people of God are, there is the church. So it's a beautiful piece of architecture. I would love to go to a divine liturgy there. That's not going to happen. Okay. I still have the presence of Christ in my life. Hopefully the Blessed Trinity dwells in my heart through grace, and whether he does or he doesn't, I have the Blessed Sacrament right upstairs from where I'm sitting and at my local parish, so I'm good.
Yes, indeed. Appreciate that. Charles, thanks so much for your email. We're heading into the second half of the program. Would love to hear from you today if you've got a question for Dr. David Anders about the Catholic faith. Maybe you'd like to share what is stopping you from becoming a Catholic. 833-288-EWTN is our number. 833-288-3986. Call to Communion on this Monday afternoon here on EWTN. Do stay with us. It's Call to Communion with Dr. David Anders. We are here for you to answer those questions of yours about the Catholic faith at 833-288-EWTN. You can get in right now if you call right now, 833-288-3986. EWTN. All right, hey, congratulations to another EWTN radio partner, the great KPIM, 102.9 FM. They serve Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, and they're celebrating 11 years with us this week. Congratulations to Adam Minahan and his great team there at St. Michael Radio from your friends here at EWTN. Interesting question came in from Thomas. Can we trace a historical lineage for Jesus, Mary, and Joseph? Can we know that they were real people?
Okay. Those two different questions.
Yeah.
Right?
Because two different questions.
Historical lineage would be the genealogy.
Well,
there are genealogies given in Scripture. They're notoriously difficult because they contradict each other. And, of course, there's no county courthouse for Bethlehem or Nazareth in the first century by which we can independently verify those sources. So, I mean, you're left with the gospel writer's testimony. But the question, can we know that Jesus, Mary, and Joseph were historical people? I think we're on the strongest grounds with Jesus because there is this very difficult, unavoidable fact about human history that there is a thing in the world called Christianity. And it's also evident that it wasn't always there, right? The Christian church had an historical origin, and there's really no dispute among historians about where that was. It was in ancient Judea in the first century. And all of the available evidence, both within and out of the New Testament, give only one explanation for the existence of the Christian church as a movement, and that is that it derives from a singular individual who was from Galilee, named Jesus, the son of Joseph the carpenter, right? And now, if you say, well, there's no historical person named Jesus, it becomes very hard to account for the origin of the Christian church, right? The Gospels themselves disagree in some matters relating to the person of Jesus. They tell the same story, sometimes with different emphases and accents, and sometimes with different facts involved, which actually is more compelling to the historical validity of the person of Christ than otherwise. If they were all carbon copies of one another, well, you would just say it was just a copy job, right? But the internal evidence of the text suggests that the gospel writers were themselves drawing on older oral traditions, right, that were in circulation. So they go back even farther than our written records. And St. Paul does the same thing. First text of the New Testament ever written, where Paul's correspondence said he began writing in the mid-40s and he would have wrapped up in the mid-60s because that's when he died. And he references things that he had learned about historical traditions about this Jesus person from those that came before him. And he's writing, in the mid-40s about things that were already well attested in oral tradition. So there is a position, there are some, in the, I will put the word in quotes here, scholarly in quotes world, that are what you call mythicists. That is to say, they hold the position that the person of Jesus of Nazareth was a myth made up by early Christianity. That is not a well-respected or attested position. Someone who is absolutely no fan of the doctrine of biblical inspiration and would be regarded by many people as an antagonist to Orthodox Christian faith would be, say, Bart Ehrman, who's probably the best-known American biblical scholar on the New Testament, whose books are bestsellers in the New York Times. Bart Ehrman, who doesn't believe that Jesus was the Son of God, has a celebrated book about why there has to have been an historical Jesus, and the mythicists are all out to lunch. He just says, look, I mean, just as an unbelieving secular atheist historian, the way I read the data is there was absolutely a guy named Jesus, and it's insane to argue otherwise. So.
Yeah. Well, there it is. And we thank you, Charles, for your email. By the way, if you would like to send us an email for a future show, the address is ctc@ewtn.com, ctc@ewtn.com. We'll get back to the phones in just a second here on EWTN's Call to Communion. I tell you what, why don't we do it right now? Here is Juan Pablo. Juan Pablo is in Killeen, Texas, listening on Sirius XM, channel 130. Going to get right to it. Juan Pablo, what's on your mind today?
Good morning. How you doing, Dr. Andrews?
Hey, Juan, doing great.
I'm calling because of the comment that I heard about the confession, the two people that a few minutes ago. In my opinion, because I've been gone for a long time, Over here in Killeen, St. Joseph, the church that I go to, they have like a screen, so, and you kneel if you want to use the screen, and also on the side is a chair. I'd rather, because of my condition that I have, I kneel next to the priest without the screen, in front of the chair, side by side in front of him. And I feel more like a weight gets off when the priest absolves me, especially when I'm ashamed of the sins, my sins, when I know that I do something really bad. And I try to confess every week or every two or three weeks, depending what I've done. But yeah, I think confession also in front of the priest, it's better if we, as humans, we humiliate ourselves, because the priest in that moment, he's not the priest. He's being the Lord Jesus.
Mm.
That's what I want to say.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, Juan Pablo. And I relate very much to what you say. And it, you know, you make an important point. And here's the point, that the sacraments are effective in us regardless of our emotional state. I can be happy about them, I can be sad about them, and they're still going to get the work done, all right? But sometimes our ability to collaborate with the grace that God offers us in the sacraments can be impacted by our emotional state. Like, you know, if I'm more encouraged or less encouraged, that has an effect. I mean, I've been to confessions before where the priest left me very encouraged about my moral life and hopeful for the future, others where I've had the opposite response. I'm absolved of my sins either way, right?
Yes.
But I'd rather walk out of the confessional in a state of mind in which I feel more confident about putting the grace that God offers me to work. And what you've said is, like, there is a way that I go to confession that leaves me refreshed in soul in a way that I feel more empowered and encouraged in my spiritual life. And I think that's great to point out, and I would encourage everybody, be alert to those things in your personality, right? Be conscious of your, Socrates, you know thyself, and the Oracle at Delphi, you know thyself.
Yeah.
Know yourself, all right? And that goes for your use of the sacraments. It goes for your use of devotions and prayers and texts and meditations you may engage in. You know, if you read the great spiritual masters, they all have their treatise on the spiritual life. One of the things I've noticed in looking at these is they're all different.
Yeah.
I mean, they have points in common, of course.
Right.
But they're all different, right?
Yeah.
And to a large extent, they reflect the idiosyncratic spirituality of each of those great names.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason they're different is that people are different.
Sure.
And so, you know, you don't have to follow the exact pattern that someone else follows in their spiritual life. You have to follow maybe the broad outlines, but not every fine little detail. You find those details that encourage you.
Juan Pablo, thanks so much for your call today from Killeen, Texas. David, you know about our parish where we go. It's a small inner city parish, but they offer both ways. You can either sit, you know, facing the priest, or you can get behind the screen, you can kneel. And I think having that choice is a wonderful thing, because as you say, you know, different things are going to resonate with different people.
Now, I have often gone to confession in my cathedral church here in Birmingham, Alabama. And it's a screen, and you don't have an option to not have a screen. But there was a priest who served there for many years who was something like a spiritual director to me. And so when I would go to confession, if he was there, I didn't really want to be anonymous because, like, we have a narrative history, you know?
Sure.
And so I would do with him what I would not do with another priest. I would kneel down and I would say, hey, Father, it's David. And then he would go, whoop, and open the screen. And
how about
we would
that?
Go face to face, you know?
Pretty
but it was
neat.
My option.
Yeah. Call to communion here on EWTN. Still time for your phone call at 833-288-EWTN. That's 833-288-3986. Here's an email from Adrian now. Do Eastern Catholics have the same canon as Latin Catholics?
No. There's a different code of canon law for the Eastern Catholic churches.
Okay.
Yeah.
Short and sweet.
Yep.
Here's one now from Leo. How can I get rid of a generational curse? I was involved with Freemasonry.
Ah, yes. So, first of all, you should stop believing in generational curses. That's the best way to get rid of them.
Okay.
The International Association of Catholic Exorcists has identified this as a this this concern as a particularly non-Catholic concern that has arisen out of Protestant and in particular Pentecostal spirituality or demonology that is not reflected in the Catholic tradition. So Catholics don't concern themselves with generational curses. That is to say, the son is not punished directly by God or afflicted by Satan in some unique way simply in virtue of what his ancestors did. Now, that's not to say that your parents or ancestors can't have an effect on you. So, you know, if you, let's say you grew up in a household where there was where there was occultic activity, and you were directly introduced to that by your parents. Well, that's not what is meant by a generational curse. Now, your parents are obviously affecting you in a really negative way there, and you're going to have repercussions in your life. But what most people mean by generational curse is the idea that somebody in your ancestral line does something, and that's some sort of congenitally sticks to your spirit. And that aspect of the doctrine is not Catholic, and you don't need to worry about it. If you were personally involved in Freemasonry as a Catholic, in violation of the code of canon law, the thing to do about that is to go to confession and say, the code of canon law says I'm not supposed to be a Freemason. I joined the Freemasons anyway. I'm sorry. Okay, for your penance, say three Hail Marys. Now go do your penance and get out of here. There you're done.
Nothing to it. Leo, thanks so much for your email. It is called a communion here on EWTN. Tomorrow morning on Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo, Steve Ray will be stopping by. Tomorrow, he'll be presenting a unique twist on purgatory from a convert's perspective. Also, Archbishop Paul Coakley of Oklahoma City. He'll be on with Teresa. He is the new head of the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. That just happened about a week or week and a half ago. So it should be a great program. That's tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. Eastern here on EWTN Radio. Let's go now to Gene in Pennsylvania, listening on the great Holy Spirit Catholic Radio. Gene, what's on your mind today?
Did you say for Gene?
Yes, go right ahead, Gene.
Yes, hi. Yes, I have a question. When a person dies, such as an example, Padre Pio or Saint Therese, they're just a regular person. And then when people pray to them, and then there's a miracle that happens, then they become saints. But before that, before they become the saint, how are they able to hear our prayers?
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So I think there may be a little bit of conceptual confusion in the question. What the Church teaches about canonization is that canonization does not change, big word coming here, the ontological state of the saint, right? The fact of canonization doesn't somehow move them, you know, in heaven from one place to another where they become capable of hearing prayers. Canonization is merely a declaration on the Church's part that this person is already in heaven.
A recognition.
Right. It's just a recognition. Yeah. Right, exactly. So if the Church didn't, let's take Padre Pio, for example. Padre Pio, we know, is in heaven. Let us say the Church never canonized him. He'd still be in heaven. Let's say the Church never canonized him. He'd still be in heaven, and he would still intercede for those who sought his intercession. Right? The only difference made by canonization is the Church is now giving public approbation to that, and therefore seeking Padre Pio's intercession can be part of the public cult of the Catholic Church, right? And cult is just a fancy word for worship. I don't mean that Catholics are in a cult, right? Not, this is a different meaning of the word. When someone is canonized, you know, they get a feast day in the Catholic calendar. You know, there are public masses said in their honor, that sort of thing. That's allowed if somebody is canonized. So I think my grandfather's in heaven. Do I have any proof of that? No. Have I had any miracles in answer to prayer? No. Does he have a date in the calendar? No. You know, there are no celebratory masses in honor of, you know, my grandfather's canonization? No. But he was a man of outstanding integrity and moral fiber and Christian faith, and so I personally believe he's in heaven. All right. The Church allows me to pray to my grandfather and ask for his intercession, which I do. All right, I do that. All right, but you know, we're not going to have the feast of Louis Hart Andrews Sr. celebrated. We're not going to name churches in his honor, that sort of thing.
Okay, Gene, thanks so much for your call from Pennsylvania. Do appreciate that. Here now is Clint in Bismarck, North Dakota, also listening on Sirius XM channel 130. Hey, Clint, what's on your mind today, sir?
Hi, I've been a listener for about a year. I am a lifelong Lutheran. I'm in a 30-year marriage with a lifelong Catholic, and sees, you know, there's similarities, what I'm trying to say is I'm not anti-Catholic, and there's many reasons that I hadn't joined, but I look, to me, I test everything off of the Catholic Church, because without the Catholic Church, there would be no Lutheran faith. And I've noticed, and I know things have really fell apart in the last 25 or 30 years in the Lutheran Church, but I notice in a lot of newer churches in general, or there's the disappearance of the red light, the eternal light or sanctuary light. I'm sure there's different names for it. I was just wondering if you had any thoughts or comments. I appreciate your vast knowledge and would just value what your comments would be on that.
Yeah, thanks. I really appreciate the question. So, as far as I'm aware, the Code of Canon Law still requires a tabernacle lamp whenever the Blessed Sacrament is reserved in the tabernacle, right? And all the churches I've been into, if you go in the church and the Blessed Sacrament is there, there's going to be a light on someplace that indicates the presence of the Blessed Sacrament. Does that mean that every Catholic parish conforms to the law? No. That's not the case. Unfortunately, there are sometimes Catholic parishes or Catholic priests that decide for whatever reason they're not going to conform to the law, right? I know a priest, actually, who took over a parish, and he found some liturgical irregularities going on from the outgoing priest, and he said to this fellow, well, I see we have these liturgical irregularities. You know that Rome has forbidden those. Outgoing priest said to my friend, huh, do you do everything that Rome says, Father so-and-so? Father so-and-so said, well, yes.
You betcha.
Absolutely. That's how we roll around here.
Yeah.
You know? I know another case of a priest who was a parochial vicar, and he was an extern priest from out of the country, and he was brought in to serve in a parish in the United States. And I won't give all the details, but suffice it to say that the director of religious education had manipulated him into a position where he was going to be asked to administer sacraments in a way that was invalid. And he didn't quite know what was being asked of him. And he said, well, why am I here? What am I supposed to be doing? Oh, well, you're supposed to do blah, 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 Father. And he was like, the heck I am. <You know? laughs> And everybody else has done it that way. Yeah, but that's not what Rome says. That's not what we're going to do. We're not going to do that today. But it does happen. You know, you'll get in some parish someplace and they want to go their own way and do their own thing. And it takes a bishop or a priest of conscience to stand up and go, nope, we're going to obey the church on this one. But yeah, I appreciate what you say about the Catholic Church sort of being the true line against which you measure, you know, other expressions of religious faith or Catholic faith or Christian faith or whatever have you. And I think that's in accord with Christ's design, right? Because what he said was, thou art Peter, thou art rock, and on this rock I'll build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Well, yes. The metaphor of a rock in Scripture is a point of stability, right? And that is the Pope's job description. He is to be a point of stability in the maintenance of Catholic doctrine. And, you know, when I was coming into the Catholic faith myself a long time ago, the papacy was actually the last doctrine for me to swallow. My pathway into the Catholic Church came first through soteriology, the doctrine of salvation. I saw that the Catholic Church is teaching on the way we are saved lined up with everything I was learning in modern biblical study about the New Testament teaching of soteriology, and that kind of unwound some of my presuppositions about my Protestant faith. And I began to look at one doctrine after another and see that the Catholics had the better side of the argument. And then I had kind of gone through a whole bunch of them, and I went, yeah, well, there's this thing, the papacy. I guess I got to deal with the papacy, you know? And I was trying to assess the historical case for the papacy. And one of the things you deal with, of course, is all these bad popes. Got a lot of bad popes in history. Some really good ones, too, but some real lousy ones. And I thought, how do I deal with the bad pope problem? And this is how I represented it to myself. I said, well, you know, what's the Pope's job description? Well, his ultimate job description is to maintain the integrity of the faith. Has he succeeded in doing that? All other things being equal.
Yeah.
And, you know, there was a Pope who was personally in theological error. It was John the 22nd. He was a 14th century Pope who maintained the private theological opinion of the doctrine of soul sleep, which is contrary to the Catholic dogma of the beatific vision.
Uh-huh.
At the time he held his opinion, it had not yet been defined as a dogma. So he wasn't a heretic. He was just wrong, right? And he died. He eventually recanted his position. And after he died, the next Pope made an infallible dogmatic declaration and defined the dogma of the beatific vision, so we wouldn't have that problem again. But nobody thinks that John the 22nd was like, you know, God's gift to the papacy. I mean, he was not like the greatest pope we ever had by any stretch of the imagination. But you know what he did do, Tom?
What's that?
He canonized Thomas Aquinas.
He sure did.
You know? And I mean, like, you know, that's, at the end of the day, the Pope's job is to maintain the faith. And even a guy like John the 22nd, at the end of the day, you know, the papacy didn't go, it didn't stop working just because he was an incompetent pope, right? And I said, okay, well, you know, if I really restrict, I have low expectations in one respect, you know, I don't expect him to be a saint necessarily, or get everything right, or have great policies, but I expect him to keep the faith of the church, and therefore it can be the true line, you know, that point of reference against which we measure other forms of Christian faith. As St. Augustine said, Roma locuta est, causa finita est. Rome has spoken, the case is closed.
Clint, thanks so much for your call from Bismarck, and thanks for your kind words about the Catholic faith. We do love hearing from you today. You know, you mentioned the title of a parochial vicar. Our call screener, Matt, says, would you call an associate pastor at a Polish parish a parochial vicar? Matt gets a rim shot. Good job, Matt. Let's go to Pam now in Baltimore, listening on the great St. Gabriel Radio. Hey, Pam, what's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. Sure. I listen very frequently. Love your show. My son is about 33, and he's been a cradle Catholic all his life, and we're all cradle Catholics, but he seems to have the persuasion that Mary Magdalene was a girlfriend of Jesus. And I told him, there's nothing in the Bible that alludes to that. And I really didn't know what else to say, but I'm thinking, you know, Christ was free of sin, and for him to engage in that kind of relationship would have been sinful. So I just don't know, you know, what to say to him the next time, if it ever comes up again.
Yeah, so the when anybody makes an historical claim, or any kind of claim for that matter, logic dictates that the burden of proof is on the one who asserts.
Yeah.
And, you know, if I say to you that that I am the king of Sweden, you would be perfectly right to respond to me, Anders, you better show me some proof that you're the king of Sweden, right? Because I think Sweden has a king and you're not he. If you think there's some case here to be made for your royalty, and then you better make it. Otherwise, it would be irrational for me to believe that claim. I have to tell you a story about the king of Sweden, though.
Oh, okay.
And that's what you do in this case. If someone makes a claim like, well, you know, Jesus was really a redheaded alien from outer space who liked pierogies. Okay, what's your evidence for that claim, right? What's your evidence for the claim that Jesus and Mary Magdalene had a romantic relationship? And there is, in fact, none. There is, in fact, none. This is a myth that was really begun in the 1980s in a popular book that came out at the time, and in sort of esoteric pseudo historical literature.
Yeah.
And then it got picked up, of course, by Dan Brown and the Da Vinci Code, and then it got super popularized and entered into popular culture. But there's zero historical basis for this, and you won't find the claim anywhere in history. So you know, what's your evidence for this?
Yeah.
What's your evidence, you know? And if, there are these secret documents. Okay, let's see them. Let's see them. And what scholar has dated these historical documents, you know? Story about the King of Sweden.
Yeah.
I had a good friend in seminary who... He was a different sort. Fine guy, though. And he was once showing us a scrapbook of his personal history. And he was like, oh, you know, he came from kind of the upper crust of New England society.
Yes.
He walked a different kind of pace than some of us folks from the South and Midwestern Seminary. And he was like, here's a picture of me, you know, playing tennis. Here's a picture of me playing polo. Here's a picture of me getting the gold medal from the King of Sweden. Oh, here's our wedding anniversary. And we're like, wait, back up. What was that? Oh, yeah, this was the yachting expedition when we won the gold medal from the King of Sweden. I went, oh, my gosh, you got to be kidding me.
You just never know.
You never know.
Pam, thanks so much for your call. We could not get to John in Hempstead, New York. John, please call us back tomorrow or on the day of your choice. We'll put you at the head of the line. God bless you. And John, thank you so much for your call. Dr. David Anders, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Tom.
We do it right here Monday through Friday at 2 p.m. Eastern on EWTN. Check out the podcast on Podcast Central, EWTN.com/podcasts. On behalf of our fantastic team, I'm Tom Price along with Dr. David Anders. Thanks for joining us. See you tomorrow on the Tuesday Call to Communion. Till then, God bless.